session number 21877, rule 5.
Jim Cramer, rule 5.
Why, we arrived back in England, very proud of ourselves, picked up our reinforcements. We followed with great interest the exploits of our sister division, the 1st. Now, if you remember, I mentioned that when I joined the Airborne Forces, we were the original 1st Division. Just before the Sicily land, the North Africa landings, that we were all sent on embarkation leave for Africa. When we came back, the division had been chopped in two. The South Staffs, the Borders, the Oxford Bucks Light Infantry, South Staffs, Borders, Shops, Staffordshire, the South Staff, Borders, Royal Ulster Rifles, what's the other one? Oh, that's Royal Ulster Rifles, don't forget Royal Ulster Rifles, was a 4-battalion brigade. We and the Oxenbucks were retained to form a new division. The South Staffs and the Borders picked up, I think, the King's Own Scottish Borders, I think, to form the 1st Air Landing Brigade. The parachute brigade were altered similarly, so that one parachute brigade, I forget which parachute brigade we kept on, to cut a long story short, there were now two divisions, the 1st and the 6th. Right, the 1st went to Normandy. The 6th went to Normandy. The 1st went to North Africa, and as far as the glider's concerned, Sicily. Now, Sicily was an appalling business. They had American pilots in their glider, American tug aircraft, apparently. On their way to Sicily, the Air Landing Brigade, were fired on by not only the Royal Navy, but they were also fired upon by the Italian and German forces in Sicily, as a result of which the inexperienced pilots, it wasn't cowardice, it's just inexperience, cast off their gliders before they reached Sicily, and as a result, 3/4 of the gliders ended up in the drink. Appalling casualty. So bad luck again. Some of the people landing by gliders crashed into stone walls. There were quite a few there. They had heavy fighting there. The parachute brigades, of course, similarly were treated sometimes. And then eventually they reached the Italian mainland, and they were then pulled back and reinforced back home. While we were in Normandy, they were given cautionary orders to get ready for particular operations, and then they had to stand down, so they were most upset about it. And then came the appalling disaster, really, of Arnhem. And we in the 6th, you know, watched with absolute, you know, misery what was happening over there, because all the guys were landed in the wrong place, far too far away from the main objectives, whereas we were landed practically on the objectives. And signals communication failure, the ill luck that 2 or 3 crack German divisions were recuperating in that area, and the very, very quick response of the German army in Germany to pour reinforcements in. And as a result, that was a division practically wiped out. So they were very unlucky. So after Arnhem, we started to prepare for Christmas. About the 22nd of December, we received, or in the middle part of December, I think, there's this awful breakthrough of the Germans in the Ardennes. Of course, we didn't have an awful lot of train formations available to plug the gap. So in the middle of all our Christmas decorations, we were told to pack our Christmas puddings and turkeys. And away we went over the channel for Belgium, the Ardennes, Luxembourg. We tried to sleep in hammocks on the way over, but couldn't. And then we had this most appalling lorry ride from, I don't know what port we landed at, Ostend or where we landed, all the way across Belgium. No, we were not far from Waterloo on the way to the Meuse. The first time I realised what an educational thing war is, because when I'd heard about the retreat from Mons, I thought it was just a village. But to my surprise, it was an enormous mining area. I went through Mons, freezing we were. Hardly any food. We landed at, finished at Dinant on the Meuse. Started pushing out patrols all over the place. Now, I've never been so uncomfortable in all my life. The winter was a murderous winter. We were digging, we were living in the snow all the time, cold. We weren't properly equipped from the clothing angle. We never had special clothing or special boots. They managed to rush a few white smocks out for the snipers, but we never had any extra leather jackets or anything. It was the most miserable time, relieved by the fact that I was now a company quartermaster sergeant, with three stripes and a crown, and I wasn't involved in actual infantry duty, so I didn't have to live and sleep in a snow-covered hole on the bank of the Meuse. But I was busy engaged in cooking for the company on these long stoves, company cookers, with a lorry, in an old farmhouse or anything I could find, with copper. That was all right until one night I was taking food up to the lines. Lance Corporal driver with a jeep and a trailer with all the stew and everything in cookers in vacuum flasks. We were stopped at a crossroad by an MP. Said there's shelling going on ahead any minute now. And then, of course, then the German shelling came. They'd obviously had this crossroads marked, registered point. And he said, when I say go to my driver, go. Because they're very methodical, the Germans. They always used to shower for about 10 minutes, shall we say. And they never rest for about 10. So I went, you go like hell. We had no lights, only little flickery things. So the corporal revved up. He said, right, then the shelling stopped. You're like, go. We went. Halfway across, all I remember was two mast headlights coming towards me. And the next thing I knew, I woke up in a hospital. Because a stupid MP the other side had told his lot to go as well. And instead of telling them to keep to the right side, the correct side of the road, for continuity, he's driving in the middle of the road. And that's all I saw. The jeep was a complete write-off. The driver was badly winded. I was unconscious for about an hour or two because my face had collided with the windscreen. So I had a concussion, a broken nose. When I woke up, I was in a former girls' school, which had been turned into a military hospital. And I was surrounded by badly wounded men, all men from the guards coming through, with dreadful injuries from some shelling they'd experienced in some I've forgotten the name of the forest, Urken Forest or something. Dreadful fighting there. And there was me with my head badly, with concussion and a broken nose, but all the other shrapnel, they used to say to me. I said, yeah. I was an indelicate part of my account. I was constipated for 3 days, you know, with the shock. So they gave me the famous number nines, the dot, the number. Well, I always thought they were big thing, but they're little black thing, you know, black licorice peels or something. A little weedy little thing. So I had those, and sure enough, about 3 days later, it started. Because it didn't all come out. It came out, as I tell my girls, talk about childbirth. I had childbirth in Belgium in 1945. Because, you know, it's trying to get out, and it's about, I swear, it's 2 inches wide, my business. And I was sweating, and it was so cold outside toilet and everything. I went in, felt a bit better. And then about a week later, I was issued with PT clip, and I had my boots, of course. And I was out on the roads with about 10 or 12 other unfortunate road walks and runs on the road was just slushy in that dreadful winter. So I got a phone call through the battalion. The battalion by then had moved to Holland on Venlo, near Venlo. The Germans still had Venlo. So they sent a jeep for me, fortunately. So I went away and I joined them. The battalion were dug in on the side of the Maas, River Maas. And I had my usual farm shed at New California. It was a spooky place. You used to go in at night sometimes looking for some, and you couldn't hear a word, just a faint popping of musketry somewhere. It's all dark. And then it got so bad, no wheelchair couldn't move. The tanks just slid all over the place. And that's where the Ardennes offensive broke down, you see. Came the end of February, beginning of March, and we were taken over by an American company. Now, an airborne company is about 120, but I'll swear the American company is about 300. And in a company, we had one lorry. One jeep and a trailer. They had about five or six of those enormous lorries of theirs with cooking equipment. You want to see their cooking arrangement? I had one cooker for that long. But these had three lorry full. They had lorries full of bridging equipment. You didn't really need a bridging equipment. And we told them not to hang around the crossroads, but no, because the Germans knew all the crossroads on their maps. They used to shell every night. No, they didn't. So we packed up quickly and fled back to, flown back from some airfield. When we were flown back by airfield, and also when we came back by sea, nobody checked us for illicit arms, you know. That's where a lot of pistols and things came back with the troops. I'll tell you what happened when I came back from Germany. And then we came back, as I was saying, a bit beginning of March, the back end of February. And we didn't lose very many men in Holland or Belgium. We just got more acclimatized and more seasoned veterans, I suppose we were, by then. Picked up a few men available, picked up new equipment. The Stens weren't a Heath Robinson thing anymore. They had the barrel the same, but the butt was a beautiful rifle butt, wooden butt, and it had a silencer. Our Stens. The barrel was surrounded by a cylinder. I suppose it's full of cylinder. Must have been full of asbestos or something. So you just heard the bolt going to and fro, not bang. Silence, Sten. You got one of those. You got some of them there, up in the Imperial War Museum. remind me, storm rifle, will you?
Yes.
They will have that the right way. Involves the museum. So that was it. We came back and we waited further orders. And then came the Rhine crossing. The Rhine, the airborne crossing of the Rhine was a good deal different from the Normandy landing. As a result of not very pleasant experiences by most of us, we realised what might lay ahead. And many, many of us, although few would admit it, had a premonition of not coming back. As a result, we got on our gliders. I've forgotten the aerodrome we flew from. On the 24th of March, 1945. The journey was quiet, uneventful, and very thoughtful. My glider was C Company's headquarters. Major Dybal, Major Hugh Weldon, Military Cross, was our company commander. We had the Jeep trailer, myself as company quartermaster sergeant, and company storeman, Rifleman Henry, and two or three others. Major Weldon was a very well-known figure in broadcasting circles, eventually became Director General of the BBC. He won his Victoria Cross, Military Cross, at the attack on St. Honorine on D plus 1, 1944. The journey, as I said before, was uneventful until we got to the Rhine. We could see the Rhine ahead. It was covered with smoke from the burning buildings of Wesel, a bit further up the river. The smoke created for the crossing of the British troops across the river, and gunfire and smoke from explosions. Halfway across the Rhine, Major Weldon realised that the glider, like pilot, was getting a bit jumpy and formed the opinion that the man had lost his nerve. As a result, he walked towards the cockpit and tried to comfort the man. Eventually we crash landed, not at Camincown, but in a kind of hollow in the ground, a mile or so from the Rhine. I crashed. There, the wheels broke through the flooring of the glider, and all earth, like Fuller's earth, buried our boots. We tried to get the door open, couldn't, and the three or four of us had to smash our way through using the axe provided for that purpose in the glider. We ran towards a rising ground just in front of us, and I suddenly realised to my horror that in our efforts to get out, I'd left my Sten gun behind, so I had to run back and get it. I reached the others, and as we came to the top, a row of ball-like howitzers appeared, and we were just on the point of surrendering. We realised that they were Americans, especially when they said, "Thank God you lads arrived." These were men who'd also crashed well away from the objective, men of the 17th United States Airborne Division. Major Weldon and I marshalled them, about 20 of them, and to our amazement, as we made our way towards Hammincown, which is indicated by the puffs of smoke, in the sky. We gathered more and more of these United States paratroopers. They were very, very jumpy and were letting off fire in all directions, even when there was no target visible. The whole ended up with us shepherding about 100 to 200 men along route, along marching column, with Major Weldon in the front and me bringing up the rear. As we got nearer and nearer Hameltown, we saw horrifying sights of men laying dead all over the place. And on one occasion, there was a burning building with what's so like rifle shots. Some of the men, the United States men, let off machine guns and rifles towards the building, and Major Wellham shouted at them to cease firing, as it's obvious that the place had been used by the German army, and the popping was the sign of ammunition going off. We got nearer and nearer Hameltown, and just as we were on the outskirts of the town, across a cornfield, or a field of high grass, we saw a very tall figure, obviously a member of the Volkssturm, not an elderly man, I should imagine he's about 45 or 50. In those days, everybody over about 30 was ancient. The man had his hands in the air, but some of the Americans were shooting at him. So Major Weldon swore at them and told them to put their arms up, but the man had crumpled, so we don't know whether he'd been killed or not. As we marched towards the where the rest of our battalion had landed, I heard a rustling in bushes, and out emerged three frightened German soldiers. One of them was about in the late 40s, with their hands in the air, and one of them offered me his watch, a pocket watch, now in the possession of my father. I didn't know whether he thought that would stop me shooting him, because we were all wearing our red berets on instructions, as we were ordered to leave our helmets on the ground just before we boarded the glider, as apparently the powers that be thought that the sight of the red berets would spread fear and consternation in the ranks of the Germans. We eventually joined our battalion, who suffered fearful losses. Over 66 men had died that afternoon at Hameltown. Dreadful afternoon. Burning gliders everywhere, bodies all over the place. We eventually went to the outskirts of the town and dug in to await a counterattack. This didn't materialise. There were no actual attacks on us, just mortaring and shell fire. While we were awaiting the arrival of the 15th Scottish Division, who was supposed to relieve us that day, we were excited, just like football supporters, at the sight of an American spotter plane landing in the fields between the German lines and ours, and a tall United States pilot got out and ran towards our lines. I don't know whether the Germans were shooting at him, but he reached our lines safely. After about a day or so in that position, the 15th Scottish Division arrived, greeted with cheers, and once again the 6th Airborne Division magazine or paper said that we were not to make disparaging remarks about the persons relieving us, nicknaming them the 15th Static Division. From then on, it was a strange situation. We did not experience many counterattacks on us, but there was plenty of fire directed at us by German Beaufort type anti-aircraft guns, various training formations who fought bravely, White flags were starting to appear in some of the towns we marched through or bypassed. Several groups of German soldiers, after a day or two, started to march towards our lines. Some of them with bands. Some of the more intelligent-looking ones we took in tow for cooks and hairdressing and so forth. And at this point, I might say, it was marked the respect that we had for the German soldier, and the German soldier presumably had for us, amongst the frontline troops. Once they shot their last bolt, used their last round, they threw their hands up in the air, and they were treated quite kindly by the frontline troops. But I've noticed on occasion, when they got to rear areas, they were kicked and otherwise very badly received, which has been par for the course, I suppose. After a few weeks, we managed to capture, on one occasion, a horse, which one of the company commanders used. I was in the rear echelon on most of the last few hundred miles of the march of the Baltic, and on one occasion, a motor fitter managed to get a German half track working once again. It was upside down in a ditch, but with a lot of manpower, we managed to get it on its tracks again, and the fitter managed to work it. And from then on, about 7 or 8 of us trundled along the roads on a half track. Once there was a gap in the traffic, the ongoing traffic, we were able to circumvent the block by going to the fields on either side, making sure there were no mines in the ditches. After a time, there's so much captured transport being used, luxury cars and so forth, found in garages, that the divisional commander made an order that all transport was to be left behind because the petrol situation was getting dire. The damage to some of the towns and cities we passed through were appalling. And it's not possible to go through many of the cities because of the collapsed buildings. In the main, it was quite a quiet time the last 3 or 4 weeks, considering mainly it was a case of receiving the surrender of hundreds of thousands of troops. On one occasion, I was a bit of an avid badge collector, and I was collecting badges and shoulder straps of various units. And one young chap, he was a cadet officer, equivalent to a sergeant major, and he said in very good English, "Ah, sergeant, I suppose you think you won the war." I said, "Well, it certainly looks like it, with a number of prisoners." He said, "Ah, there's only one victor in this war, that's those bastards over the other side," presumably meaning our Russian allies. We managed to equip ourselves with some very fine weapons en route. I picked up nearly a prototype, a German Sturmgewehr, storm rifle, which was the forerunner of the Russian Kalashnikov. This, I saw very few of these. They were gas operated, very accurate, very high rate of fire, and I got a German metal gas mask container full of ammunition for after the war target practice on the ranges at Portsmouth, and I got a very nice sniper rifle and a Schmeisser, which I later handed over to the Portsmouth Police Headquarters for them to look after me, well, after for me, which they failed to do. They surrendered it to the depot for this type of prohibited weapons. I never had my targets practiced. We were also struck by the number of Russian and other nationality prisoners of war. The Russians had armed themselves with some captured weapons and were going around shooting any German soldier they could find, so we had to disarm them. On one occasion, we captured a farm, and our divisional cook was able to get it killed. We had a good repast, but some of the Russian women prisoners came up and begged for the head so that they could.